Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy is brought to you in part by Tom's Place. For the finest in men's fashion, Tom's Place will suit you. Located in Toronto at 190 Baldwin Street in the heart of Kensington Market. Or visit toms-place.com. This is Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. Listen, laugh, and learn.
When was the first Olympic foot race?
Do not, by all means, do not stop a sneeze. We'll tell you why. Hi, I'm Nick.
And I'm Roy. And this week, we scoured the internet to get these totally useless tidbits for you.
Plus, we'll open up our mailbag. And in the news, he placed antiques up his kilt. What could go wrong?
Totally useless information. It's everything you never needed to know.
And the number one jingle voted by you.
Einstein was a moron. Newton was a jerk. Science.
Welcome once again, 72 countries and counting on the iHeartRadio Talk Network. We are coast to coast to coast in Canada. So today we brought back another popular guest. He was with us at our Christmas party. He joined us, I think it was season two or season three, talking about animals. But this is how talented he is. He's iHeartRadio's science correspondent, Dan Riskin, and he's back. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, guys. Good to be
here. Yeah, we actually, the last time you were on the show, we got mail about you.
Really?
So, yeah, that's big because most of the time people just curse us out for the guests that we bring, but you got good mail.
Yeah, and also...
Yeah. Normally I attract females, but who knows? You know, it's
What you mean is, Roy, is that we didn't get a restraining order this week. It's a record.
Yeah, it is actually. Yeah.
So let's talk some science here. So what Dan has done is he's kind of sent us a few teases because... He has so much knowledge of science that he said, just give me the headlines and I'll tell you all about it. So, for example, here's the first one.
Wait.
Yes?
Nick.
Yes.
What is he doing on the show if he's actually knowledgeable?
Yeah, but you see, this is how talented he is. He's knowledgeable with useless information about science.
Good.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
This might be useful. I don't know. You might kick me off. This might be where you get your hate mail. Is people might say, "Wait, that's
good." We like the hate mail, Dan. Okay.
Dan? Every once in a while, we provide useful information, and so we apologize to the audience. So we will, as a disclaimer, apologize ahead of time, just in case we give you useful information. Listener discretion is advised. Looking for a way to highlight your skills, Roy, without sounding like a pompous ass. Can I say ass? Yeah, I can. Try this. Yeah. Try humor bragging. What's that all about, Dan? Humor bragging.
Humor bragging is this new technique that's been developed by very smart scientists as a way. It's that fine line you have to walk when you send in your resume or you are in a job interview or you're talking to that potential employer and just trying to like introduce yourself. You got to say as many good things about yourself as possible, but if you overdo it, they'll hate you because that's just a hateable trait, right? When somebody's like, oh, I'm really good at this and I'm good at this and I'm good at this, like, get out. I don't want to work with you. So this new technique, it's not humble bragging, it's humor bragging. And the idea is you tell a sort of punchline as you're rolling through your self-congratulatory remarks in a way that sort of, you know, you're laughing together at how ridiculous it is that these things are being said. So, for example, for one experiment, they had people apply for these jobs, real jobs, and they were sales jobs. And half the people wrote, you know, they had the same resume and they applied for the job and all that stuff. And then half the people had the same thing. But instead of saying, I have a proven track record of, you know, sales, this and that and the other thing, they said, I have a proven track record of turning caffeine into productivity. The more coffee you can provide, the more output I will produce. Mm-hmm. So it's a little dumb joke, and it was just the one joke, but it's just enough to show I have a sense of humor about how great I am.
You know, and it's funny though, because Dan actually did that a couple of minutes ago when we were talking, and Dan said that he attracts women. See how he did that? He used the humor thing.
He did. Yeah, and he does fantastic.
I was bragging also, I guess. It is useful to me. I don't know if it's useful to listeners, but I hope they can use it. But yeah, that's just it. That sense of humor goes a long way. They did another experiment where people read a transcript of a job interview. So somebody was interviewing for a job at a bakery. Mm-hmm. And in the interview, they're asked, you know, did you ever make a cake that was really important? And the story is about, I made a cake shaped like a soccer ball for a kid for their birthday. And in one version, they just tell the story. In the other version, they tell the story and they say, but thank goodness I wasn't asked to kick the soccer ball because I'm terrible at soccer. Just a dumb little one joke. Not like listening to an episode of your show where it's just constant and it never stops and people are just begging for mercy. One joke, just one, is enough to show that you'd be kind of fun to work with.
But then I think you risk you take the risk of the fact that the person may say, well, that wasn't funny. And then they don't hire you.
Yeah, that's true too. Or this person thinks they're applying for a job as a comedian and we really need somebody to bake cakes. And I don't know if I can handle that constantly.
Plus, exactly. Not to mention the soccer ball is crooked. Your ball is crooked. Your ball is lopsided.
I love a geometry joke.
Yeah.
Your sphere is slanted to the side. That's a great joke.
Oh, yes, Dan.
Put that down. That is a good joke. That is a joke. Yeah.
You know us really well.
Pythagoras and Archimedes would agree.
You've been on enough times to know that both Roy's and my spheres are way off base. Way off. We need spectacles.
My sphere slants to the right.
What else? So, Roy, what did Dan send you? Because he sent us different headlines here. What did he send you?
For bilingual people, which language you're currently thinking in will affect how much pain you feel when you get hurt.
Yeah, this is a Florida study. This is Florida. So this was actually done in Miami. And so that's why I thought you would like getting it, which is why I sent it to you specifically.
So if it was done in Miami, the entire study was done in Spanish.
Well, it was half done in Spanish. That's just it. So a lot of people who live in Miami speak Spanish, but they often work in English. And so you have a lot of bilingual people. And so what they did is they brought people into the lab, and they put this thing on their arm that transmits heat. And it's enough heat that it hurts, but it doesn't burn you, like do damage. But it's enough that you want to take it off. And so first they put these things on and they give people, you know, different amounts of heat, and they calibrate it, you know, on a scale of like, what's the most heat you can handle? Let's call that a 10. Now feel this. Okay, well, what's that on a scale of 1 to 10? Okay, now feel this. What's that on a scale of 1 to 10? They do that. And at the same time, they scan their brains. And while they're doing it, they say to these people, I want you to be thinking in Espanol, or I want you to be thinking in English. And these people, these 39 adults, were all people who spoke Spanish at home and spoke English when they were outside or when they were at work or whatever. And what they found is that when people are thinking in their native language, in Spanish, the pain is higher than for the same amount of heat than compared to when you're thinking in another language, which you could say it's just muy caliente or something. I can't speak Spanish.
I know, I got one. It's ay caramba. Ay caramba.
Ay caramba.
Yes, it's something like that. But they think, I mean, there are a lot of different sort of possibilities for this, but one possibility is that your cognitive load is kind of busy with translating, and that reduces the bandwidth you have to deal with the fact that you're in pain. And so you just, you have less of your brain associated with sensing that pain and processing.
I think it might be the fact that when they feel the heat and that heat is hot, they're afraid to say it because the person might get ice. Get it? Get ice?
Ice?
Or they'll get deported.
I thought you meant for their drinks. It's not for their drinks. Oh, I see. Gotcha. All right. Ay caramba, indeed. All right. So I've played softball over the years, and I've run into an umpire, and because I disagreed with the call, and I've seen my cousin plays hockey, and he started yelling and screaming at the referee. So I'm going to ask you, Dan. I'm going to ask you this. Okay. Does it really work when you yell or just throw obscenities or whatever at the referee or umpire? Does that really work? Will that change their mind of what call they just made?
Yeah, my experience has been that no amount of yelling from anybody ever makes them reverse the call they just made. But the what might change is how they treat your team going forward. Maybe there's a world in which the ref fails to call that penalty and you got high-sticked and you're bleeding and you say, you missed that, you're an idiot. And they have this little bit of remorse so that the next time they're just a little bit more likely to call something on your, you know, on your behalf.
And I've had a referee change his call at gunpoint.
Yeah, it was skeet shooting.
That's not a referee. That's a bank teller. Right. That's a totally different.
He knows you
It's more lucrative that way.
I'm sure.
Wow.
And then you're the one wearing stripes afterwards instead of the referee.
Good point. There you go. Yep.
I look good in stripes as long as they're up and down. Side by side makes me look fat.
We can't have that.
Yeah.
So I don't have any data from hockey, which would be the data I'm most interested in, because I'm usually, when I'm yelling at a referee, it's having to do with an Oilers game in all likelihood. But in baseball, lots of good data. So researchers took a decade of data and they looked at hundreds of thousands of games, and they found 1,200 games in which a player was ejected, a player or a manager, somebody on a team. And they were not just ejected, period. They were ejected by the home plate umpire because they were making noise about some call or something like that. And so they made sure that all 1,200 of these ejections were of the same ilk. And then they looked to see what happens before that in the game and after that in the game in terms of how the umpire is calling strikes and balls with the ones where the batter does not swing. So if the batter swings, you know, it's pretty cut and dry. So you don't really include that as the judgment call of the umpire. But when the ball goes over the plate or near the plate or whatever, the umpire has to make the call. Is it a strike or is it a ball? And so that's sort of the interesting data they dove into. And what they found is that, let's say somebody on the Blue Jays goes up and makes all this noise and says, this is no fair, you missed the call, you're an idiot, and then gets kicked out of the game. According to these data, the umpires are 3% less likely to call a strike against a Blue Jays batter after that. So it actually does decrease the amount of strikes you get from that umpire. So it does help the team. And it also helps the team because that umpire becomes 0.5% more likely to call strikes against the team you're playing against. So if it's the Yankees, they're going to be 0.5% more likely to call strikes against the Yankees. And so if you're the manager of the Blue Jays and you're losing by a smidge and you want to get you just want to change the momentum, you might be helping your team by going and yelling at that umpire and getting kicked out of the game because they're going to change how they call things afterwards.
You know, I coached kids football, and I got ejected. I got ejected
really?
From the game. Yeah, I told the referee. I said, listen, you moron. I said, do you want me to go get you a new pair of glasses? Mm-hmm. I said, you sure those are your glasses or your wife's glasses? He said, you got to go into the parking lot and wait for the kids.
Nick and Roy will continue with totally useless information. We're back with totally useless information with Nick and Roy. Listen, laugh, and learn.
Okay, now this one really caught my attention. An intact housefly was found inside a 63-year-old Missouri man's colon during a routine colonoscopy. First off, there's nothing about routine about colonoscopy. But anyway.
Well, it was routine for the person doing the procedure. They were.
An intact fly.
An intact fly. So, like, the picture is astounding. It's just a fly on a wall, and the wall is colon-shaped. It's just the inside of a cave. It's just, it's amazing. And so they've got these cameras that they put in there, and they're looking around for polyps and all that stuff, and they're, you know, doing their fishing expedition, and you expect to find, you know, the kinds of things you find in there where the sun don't shine, but you do not expect to find a fly on the wall. Now, the fly on the wall was not alive. It was dead, but it looked totally fine. It was not what a fly would look like if you had eaten a fly and then swallowed the fly and then had to go through your digestive tract and get digested by all those acids and then make it all the way through your your small intestine and then finally get to your colon. Like, a fly would be ripped to shreds by that. That's kind of how the digestive system works. Is like, if you eat a fly, you digest it. That's the whole
point. So I'm wondering, did the fly go the other way?
Yes. Did the fly go the other way? They don't know. I mean, this guy, he said nothing weird happened. Like, he's just, you know, he doesn't have any story.
Questions.
He went to the bathroom a couple days ago.
Really, two questions, Dan. Two very important questions. Question number one was, did the fly go the other way? Question number two was, Dan, do you enjoy looking into men's colon?
If there's a fly, I think it's worth at least academically looking into the issue. I was happy to look at a photograph on my computer screen as opposed to having to take, you know, do the smell test myself or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I gotta say, like, it is a good mystery, right? Like, it really is it's published in a scientific journal. They really saw this thing. It seems impossible it went in one way. It also seems really unlikely that a fly is going to go into a person's anus without them noticing, and then crawl well into the
what did the fly do? Did he knock first before he went into the sphincter? Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you're doing that sun tanning thing that I think some has become popular with some really right wing men, where they get the sun on their between their legs and they hold their Have you seen this where men like try to sun the bottom of their carriage? Have you seen this?
No,
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it, Dan, because I can't get my head down there while I'm doing it.
Yeah, right. There it is.
Well, although anyway, I beg to differ. So what's this all? What is this new trend there, Dan?
Well, it's some. I don't know that it's new, but I remember seeing it about a year ago where men were trying to let the sun shine on their the underside between their legs. They were lifting their legs and spreading their legs apart and like trying to get a sunburn where you don't want a sunburn, as far as I'm concerned,
right?
Because they felt like it was going to do something for their manliness or something like this. But that is one situation in which maybe a fly would have a chance at achieving what we're hypothesizing. Another possibility,
you'd know that though, Dan, you would know that because the fly would have had goggles on.
Sun tanning goggles.
What was the other thing you were saying, Dan?
Well, the third possibility is that like maybe they ate a maggot, and or maybe a maggot infected them, and then it hatched while
that would be it. Because
that has not come out in the list of hypotheses. I didn't find that anywhere in the scientific paper. So either I'm so creative that I came up with this maggot idea, or there's some reason that that's not possible.
I hate maggots.
I
hate them.
Do you know my maggot story?
No.
You don't know my maggot story. So when I was a bat biologist and I was working in Belize, I got what's called a bot fly. Have you heard of these?
No.
No.
Oh, you guys are going to love this. A bot fly is a species of fly that never comes near people. But what it does is it catches a mosquito in the air and it lays eggs on the mosquito and then it lets the mosquito go.
Ooh.
And then the mosquito lands on the bat biologist and it drops the eggs off. With the heat of your skin against the mosquito is what triggers it. And then once the eggs are there, they hatch, or one of them hatches, into a maggot. And then it goes down into the hole that the mosquito drank out of. And then it gets stuck. Yeah. And then it feeds on you and it grows. And if you let it go, it can get to be, I mean, pretty big, like, I don't know, like a centimeter long or bigger than that. And it's got these spikes on it, so you can't squeeze it out. Like, it's like a zit. It was on my head. And I was squeezing it like crazy, and I could not get this thing out. So eventually, I had to go to the hospital. And I'll tell you, at the hospital in Edmonton, they had not ever heard of a bot fly. And so that was really exciting, because then they were like, well, we got to get the expert. And so then I had like this parasitologist come and look, and a whole bunch of med students were looking at my head. And nurses were grossed out. And I feel like that is, for me, one of the – I have a couple accomplishments that I'm really proud of, but grossing out a nurse. Like, nurses don't blink when people barf in front of them, and like they deal with the worst stuff. But to gross out a nurse, I really
or,
feel
or
like
poop
I
out know. Flies, for that matter. Yeah. To
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So,
nurses, that's
gross out a nurse or look up someone's colon.
Listen, you know, now, you know how they knew there was a fly in there, and Roy knows this because in one of our first episodes, we talked about how the house fly hums in the key of F. And so when this patient, well, passed gas, it was in the key of F. They knew there was a house fly in there.
Now, let me ask you a question. So, Dan, so what'd they have to do? Cut it out, lance it, and cut it out?
It wasn't quite a lance, but it was a slash.
No, his name was Lance. You got that wrong.
Lance, Dr. Lance.
Yeah, and also the guitarist for Guns N' Roses was in the room. It was very confusing.
Exactly. Slash. Slash and Lance.
So they cut my head open and they got it up. There was blood everywhere.
Yeah. It was like as he was cutting, you heard.
I wasn't sunning myself. This is not a bot fly that got me while I was
doing
it.
Oh, yeah. We have pictures. We have pictures that prove otherwise. But anyway, Dan Riskin.
Yeah, because you never want somebody to lance you there. I'll tell you.
No, you don't. No.
I knew a doctor once. His name was.
I used to call that my lance, but it was a different story.
Calling Dr. Lance Boyle. Dr. Lance Boyle. Dan Riskin, iHeartRadio's science correspondent. Oh, it was such a joy. We have to have you back again.
It really wasn't a joy. It was kind of disgusting.
That's the best kind of joy, isn't it, Sir Lance? I think that's the way to go.
Exactly. Dan Riskin, thanks for joining us on Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy.
Why, Dan's got to go? We got to get rid of Dan?
I got
does he have to go to the hospital?
No, the sun's high in the sky. I got to go do something. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Dan Riskin.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Dan.
You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy.
Sports. Play ball.
That was cool with Dan.
That was awesome. Yeah, he always brings it. He came to us the first time with animals, and then he was part of our Christmas party.
He brings it not only to the show, he also brings it to the hospital.
That's right. Quite a story. Anyway, speaking of balls, here's Roy with sports.
Yes, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You know how many points he scored? Don't look it up either.
No, I'm not going to look it up.
38,387 points in 20 seasons with the Bucks and the Lakers. 38,387 points. And he was also in a karate film with Bruce Lee.
Really?
I don't know if you know that.
No, I did not. Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Chuck Norris, Bruce Lee, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, I believe. No, I forget who was the other third person. It wasn't Chuck Norris. It was a guy. I can't remember his name, but I'll get it. Eventually.
Okay. So how about doing sports? So this is an event that happened from 1946 to 1955. And yes, I remember it well. I was there. I was covering. I took pictures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's baby crawling races. The National Institute of Diaper Services, United States, held annual baby crawling races, or diaper derbies, as they put it.
Diaper derpies.
That is diaper
English,
herpes.
English, Nick.
Okay,
English.
Sorry.
Because we don't want you feeling the pain in another language.
No way. That's right. Exactly. Ay, caramba. Such races are having a resurgence. So their baby races now are really popular in Japan. The most well-known...
Because sometimes you don't even know if it's an adult because they're usually very short.
And also, you can mistake them for sumo wrestlers, I guess. With the
they're
diapers.
Kinky. They're kinky, too. You know, they're running around the men in diapers, you know?
So that's Japan. But the most well-known race is the annual baby crawling competition in Lithuania.
Oh, the old Lithuania baby crawling competition.
It's held to celebrate International Children's Day.
Nick and Roy will continue with Totally Useless Information.
Hi, Nick and Roy for Tom's Place. Here comes the groom. If there's a wedding on your calendar, listen up.
Tom is the best man to dress the entire wedding party, including father of the bride or groom or special guests. Why rent when it's so affordable to buy a classic you can wear again? Formal or informal tailored suits or classic tuxedos and all the accessories. But remember, folks, you rent a tuxedo, you bring it back. You buy one, you have it for life, and you'll use it, I'm telling you.
At Tom's Place, get ready for the spotlight. Find out more at Tom's Place in Kensington Market. No one can save you more or dress you better than their wedding specialists.
And enter our wonderful wedding contest at toms-place.com. That's Toms with an S, -place.com, to win a $500 credit for your wedding party outfits. That's toms-place.com. Enter in the wonderful wedding contests. I'm telling you, at Tom's Place, we'll suit you.
Go to our website, nickandroy.com, and click on the Tom's Place logo, and you'll find out all about the great contest at Tom's Place. 190 Baldwin Street in the heart of the Kensington Market. Tom's Place will suit you. Let us show you how.
We're back with Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. Listen, laugh, and learn.
I'm going to do my teaser.
Okay.
The first Olympic foot race was held in 776 BC. Nick, how was it?
I was only, you know what? I was crawling in diapers, so I wouldn't know.
He was at the diaper race. No, but the first Olympic foot race, 776 BC, that's before Christ. Mm-hmm. It was won by a man. They have his name.
Oh.
Corbus, C-O-R-B-U-S, Corbus. And they even have his occupation. He was a chef. That was his actual occupation.
Really? Wow.
Yep, he did the foot race, and Corbis, he's so popular that he's like Cher. He only has one name,
right.
Corbis.
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 Now, you're funny you should talk about feet. So here's another
story. Actually, he had brothers too. Corbis, Yellow Bus, his brother.
Right.
City Bus was his other cousin.
Right. And his cousin, Omnibus.
Omnibus.
Speaking of feet, here's a sport, toe wrestling.
Ooh, toe wrestling.
Yeah, now you think the rules for toe wrestling are pretty simple. Well, they are. But first of all, you have to take your shoes off. The competitors face other, not face to face, but toe to toe across the toe-dium. Okay.
Ooh, the toe-dium.
Where they interlock their big toes and try to force each other off of the toe-dium. It's like arm wrestling, but with toes.
There's risks to this sport. There's fungus risks.
That's right. Yes, the eight mushroom.
And what's the prize? Like a pedicure?
It is. I wonder if it's sponsored by Dr. Scholl's. The world. Now, hold on. So there's a World Toe Wrestling Championship, and it's not new. The history goes way back to 1976 when the World Toe Wrestling Competition started at where else? At a pub in the UK.
Of course, right.
Where the contestants lock their big toes together and attempt to force their opponent's foot to the ground. So the
in the UK.
Yeah, the World Toe Wrestling Championships.
It's like drinking like 8 pints of Guinness, you know.
That's right.
It's like, how'd you like me to put my big toe into your big toe? You know, it's like, okay. Okay, you weirdo. While Dan Reskin's looking up someone's colon. Going on in this bar.
He thought he was talking about punctuation.
Yeah, and before you said omnibus, off the bus, on the bus.
Right,
on the
bus. Exactly. Okay.
But anyway, this one was a cool one. I know you'll like this because you're baseball.
Oh, yeah, big fan.
Me, I could care less.
Right.
The first player to be a designated hitter in the World Series, in a World Series, excuse me.
Okay.
So the first player to be a designated hitter in a World Series, his name was Danny Heap.
Danny Heap.
And think about this. His initials are DH.
Oh, right.
Designated hitter, DH. No pun, though. No pun intended with that.
Okay.
He also was best known. Danny Heap was the 4,000th Nolan Ryan strikeout.
Wow.
So he's known for two famous events in baseball. He's the first World Series designated hitter. His initials are DH, and he was the 4,000 strikeout.
That's amazing. That's pretty cool. Thank you for that. You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. We're talking about sports, and I'm going to tell you about Nude Beach Olympics.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah. And then they told you, then you got ejected from the Nude Beach Olympics, just like you were ejected from the football.
They said, hey, you can't bring that tripod with you.
Yeah, that's right. You just wanted to take pictures. It was held.
They said, no pets on the beach. Snakes, go back in the car.
Well, it was held at, and I think you'll appreciate this, at Baker Beach since 1998. It was invented by George Davis, and the events have been part of a program which includes some of these things, among other sports.
I'm sure there's a lot of events.
Oh, well, the sumo wrestling.
Oh, boy.
Why not? There's Greco-Roman wrestling.
Oh, I thought they were the same.
Touch football.
Of course.
And finally, the javelin throw.
Does the body go with it?
Yes.
The body throw, you got to use your hips.
To really get your thrust, you got to thrust it to hit it.
You got
to
get
it.
Look, wow. Did you see the commentators? Well, that was an amazing thrust.
Exactly.
So let's get abreast of touch football.
What a boob. The Nude Beach Olympics.
No, I'm sorry, sir. This is Greco-Roman wrestling. No javelin throwing.
They got the two sports mixed up.
Before the 1900s, prize fights were allowed to go 100 rounds.
Wow.
Okay, I actually watched a Jack Johnson fight. I think it was a Jack Johnson fight that went 90 rounds. Gentleman Jim Corbett and Jack Johnson.
Wow.
I'd have to look that one up, but it was so absurdly long that they almost passed out the both of them. And of course, at the end, I think gentleman Jim Corbett wins. Jack Johnson falls down, but in controversy, because they said he actually shielded his eyes from the sun, and if you were knocked out, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Wow. Yeah.
So there was controversy in it as well. But of course, after 1900, they said, we can't do this. Somebody's going to die.
No.
So they limited them to 20 rounds.
Wow.
Which you don't see anymore anyway. 12-round fight is the long one.
Those who are fans of the show, thanks for listening. You know that Roy and I have been friends for many, many years, 42-plus years. We met in high school. Roy has played a lot of sports. He played football. He played tennis, right? Tennis?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Now, one of the things that Roy has yet to try out, but although he has put his name he's on a waiting list for this.
I haven't done that naked javelin throwing yet. I'm very interested in learning that.
No, but what he did put his name for, and he's on the waiting list, for the ferret legging race.
Oh, the old ferret legging.
It's endurance contest to see who can keep the ferret in their trousers the longest.
Well, Dan Reskin doesn't put the ferret in his trousers with the whole colon story.
No, it doesn't. Exactly. So this is an endurance contest.
Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, he's not here.
The secret's out.
That's right. That's not all that's out. So this is an endurance.
That's not all that's in.
That's right. Wow. This is an endurance contest to see who can keep the ferret in their trousers the longest. It became really popular from the 1970s among the coal miners in where else? England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, at the same bar.
That's right. Sounds about right.
Oh, there's Dan Ruskin again.
Male-only participants put live ferrets inside their pants. Mm-hmm. They tie their pants at the ankles before placing the two ferrets. There are two of them. Inside,
well, put one in each leg.
That's right, and fastening their belts.
Oh yeah!
Now,
fasten that belt pretty tight.
That's right. Now, just to make an equal opportunity, a female version was once held where the ferrets were inserted inside their blouses, but it wasn't
because if you put them in the legs and only one ferret comes out, that would be interesting.
According to the rules, now the rules are adhered to.
Oh, there's rules.
Yes. Contestants are not allowed to wear underwear. The ferrets must have a full set of teeth.
Oh, this is bad.
In order to win the contest, the men must simply not care when the tool is bitten.
No, we're not doing this. And then they have to run with the ferrets?
No, the winner is the last to release the animal.
Okay.
It's an endurance test, okay?
Yeah. Right. They're like, oh, it's ferret's over. Let's go to the bar and watch some toe wrestling.
That's right. That's not my toe. You're listening to Totally Uses Information with Nick and Roy. Oh, thanks very much for joining us. If you're still listening, we really appreciate it. And you go to our website, nickandroy.com. You check on the Nick and Roy story. Here's what's really cool about that. So you go to the birthday messages, and not only is it inexpensive, it's way better than that other place where, you know, celebrities say, hey, I'm a celebrity, and, you know.
Yeah,
whatever.
They just say, hi, my name is, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't even know half of these celebrities anymore. Right. And they go, happy birthday to you, and that's the end of it. No, yeah. Nick and I, famous in 74 countries around the world now?
72, but it'll be 74.
72.
Soon. Yeah.
72 countries around the world.
Right.
We actually do a show. We do a totally useless information show about the day that you were born, the day and year that you were born. And it's a lot of fun. It is the coolest gift you will ever give somebody. And if somebody says, I have everything, well, guess what? They don't, unless they've already gotten one. And in that case, they're buying it for their friends.
This is what they're saying. They're saying they loved it. They found it very entertaining and yet educational.
So, maybe not as entertaining as a ferret race, but
no, it's not. But go to nickandroy.com. Click on the Nick and Roy store.
Nick and Roy will continue with Totally Useless Information. You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. Listen, laugh,
from
and learn.
To Bieber. Rock and roll. To rhythm and blues. This is Totally Useless Music Information with Nick and Roy.
We are the world. We are the children. Remember that song from 1985?
I remember when really people that could sing sang it.
What was the old joke? You know, hey, who sings that song? Lionel Richie. Let's keep it that way, shall we? Now, Quincy Jones had already produced some of Michael Jackson's biggest albums, right? And he also produced We Are the World. There's a new documentary that has part of an interview where Quincy says Michael didn't originally want to sing on it. How about this huge artist who decided not to take part in the We Are the World song? It was Prince.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
While he was on board with the idea, because he loves, he's a philanthropist and gave to charities throughout his career.
He said, I can't possibly sing on that. I'm royalty.
That's right. Yes. Now, he had other commitments that prevented him from joining the Singers. Now, Sheila E., which I believe he was his girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, and performed in his band.
She.
The Revolution.
That's right, Prince and the Revolution. Yeah. She was invited to sing We Are the World, but really they were using her to convince Prince to come sing with them.
She was beautiful, Sheila E. She was a good looking woman,
yeah.
But listen, Nick, you said Quincy Jones. You know, a lot of people, when I'm doing shows and I do Just Once, which was sung by James Ingram.
Right, of course.
Written by Quincy Jones.
Didn't know that. Wow.
Yes. There you go. Listen. And performed originally by Quincy Jones, and then he gives it to James Ingram because he thinks he would do a much better
job. And he did. You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. Listen, laugh, and learn. We just proved it.
Yeah, the piano, a piano.
Yes.
You have a vision in your head, this beautiful wooden piece of furniture, right?
Yes, yes.
Most people think it's mostly wood, but they don't understand that inside the piano is a harp, and the harp is made of iron.
Oh.
Now, it's literally, that's what makes pianos so heavy. It's an iron harp. And the reason it's made of iron is because piano strings are pulled at a tension of 20 tons.
Wow.
So if it's not made out of iron, it would collapse. How cool is that? You talk about totally useless information. Piano strings are strung at a rate of 20 tons.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who are high strung, but that's something totally
different. That's pretty much like Nick's first girlfriend.
That's right. The high strung, yes. And you don't know, she played the guitar. And she, for some reason, she didn't want to give me her G string.
Oh my God, you're going to the ball with Dan Risk.
We'll go toe-to-toe with him. Paul, listen.
Maybe that's where the saying comes from, toe-to-toe.
Maybe, who knows?
At that bar.
It is. According to the rules, now the rules are adhered to.
Oh, there's rules.
Yes. Contestants are not allowed to wear underwear.
And the
ferrets must have a full set of teeth.
Oh, this is bad.
In order to win the contest, the men must simply not care when the tool is bitten. And
No, we're not doing this. And then they have to run with the ferrets?
No, the winner is the last to release the animal.
Okay.
It's an endurance test, okay?
Yeah. Right. They're like, oh, it's ferret's over. Let's go to the bar and watch some toe wrestling.
That's right. That's not my toe. You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. Oh, thanks very much for joining us. If you're still listening, we really appreciate it. And you go to our website, nickandroy.com. You check on the Nick and Roy story. Here's what's really cool about that. So you go to the birthday messages, and not only is it inexpensive, it's way better than that other place where, you know, celebrities say, hey, I'm a celebrity, and, you know.
Yeah,
whatever.
They just say, hi, my name is, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't even know half of these celebrities anymore.
Right.
And they go, happy birthday to you, and that's the end of it. No, yeah. Nick and I, famous in 74 countries around the world now?
72, but it'll be 74.
72.
Soon. Yeah.
72 countries around the world.
Right.
We actually do a show. We do a totally useless information show about the day that you were born, the day and year that you were born. And it's a lot of fun. It is the coolest gift you will ever give somebody. And if somebody says, I have everything, well, guess what? They don't, unless they've already gotten one. And in that case, they're buying it for their friends.
This is what they're saying. They're saying they loved it. They found it very entertaining and yet educational.
So, maybe not as entertaining as a ferret race, but
no, it's not. But go to nickandroy.com, click on the Nick and Roy store.
We promise the next birthday message, we will do a show with a ferret in our pants.
That's right. You're listening to...
Now, really, folks, go to nickandroy.com. Tap on the Nick and Roy store. You'll see birthday message. You can actually listen to a sample of it. It's so cool. It is such a great gift. Do it. you'll be happy you did. And the person that gets it will be, they call all their friends. They haven't listened to it. It's so cool.
That's on our website, nickandroy.com.
From Beethoven to Bieber, rock and roll to rhythm and blues. This is Totally Useless Music Information with Nick and Roy.
We are the world. We are the children. Remember that song from 1985?
I remember when really people that could sing sang it.
What was the old joke? You know, hey, who sings that song? Lionel Richie. Let's keep it that way, shall we? Now, Quincy Jones had already produced some of Michael Jackson's biggest albums, right? And he also produced We Are the World. There's
a new documentary
that has part of an interview where Quincy says Michael didn't originally want to sing on it.
So no, he wrote it, I believe.
He was part of that. Eventually, they convinced him. And how about this huge artist who decided not to take part in the We Are the World song? It was Prince.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
While he was on board with the idea, because he's a philanthropist and gave to charities throughout his career.
He said, I can't possibly sing on that. I'm royalty.
That's right. Yes. He had other commitments that prevented him from joining the Singers. But during this time, he was giving, you know, his time to other philanthropic ways, as I said. Now, Sheila E., which I believe he was his girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, and performed in his band.
She.
The Revolution.
That's right, Prince and the Revolution. Yeah. She was invited to sing We Are the World, but really they were using her to convince Prince to come sing with them. So she knew all about it.
Actually, have you ever seen Sheila E.? I would have tried to convince her too.
That's right.
She was beautiful, Sheila E. She was a good-looking woman. Yeah.
Right.
But listen, Nick, you said Quincy Jones. You know, a lot of people when I'm doing shows and I do Just Once, which was sung by James Ingram.
Right, of course.
Written by Quincy Jones.
Didn't know that. Wow.
Yes.
There you go.
Listen. And performed originally by Quincy Jones, and then he gives it to James Ingram because he thinks he would do a much better
job. He did. You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy. Listen, laugh, and learn. We just proved it.
Yeah, the piano,
Yes.
You have a vision in your head, this beautiful wooden piece of furniture, right?
Yes.
Most people think it's mostly wood, but they don't understand that inside the piano is a harp, and the harp is made of iron.
Oh.
Now, it's literally, that's what makes piano so heavy. It's an iron harp. And the reason it's made of iron is because piano strings are pulled at a tension of 20 tons.
Wow.
So if it's not made out of iron, it would collapse. How cool is that? You talk about totally useless information. Piano strings are strung at a rate of 20 tons.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who are high strung, but that's something totally
different. That's pretty much like Nick's first girlfriend.
That's right. The high strung, yes. And you don't know, she played the guitar. And she, for some reason, she didn't want to give me her G string.
Oh my God, that's horrible. You're going to the ball with Dan Riska.
We'll go toe-to-toe with him. Paul, listen.
Maybe that's where the saying comes from, toe-to-toe.
Maybe, who knows?
That bar.
It is. Listen, Paul McCartney's guitar was found. Yeah. He lost his guitar? His Hofner bass guitar.
The coolest guitar in the world.
The
one
most
that looks
important.
Like a violin. That's what that is.
Now, the most important bass in history for its role in the creation and recordings of dozens of the Beatles' classics has been found over 50 years after it first went missing.
Mm-hmm.
There was this whole Lost Bass Project, a grassroots campaign that hoped to discover what happened to the instrument. The 1961 Hofner 500/1 bass guitar had been rediscovered, and McCartney himself confirmed it in a statement that he has it back. Despite his 50.
He said, I know this is mine because it says on the back of it, this belongs to Paul McCartney. Along with his underwear that said Wednesday.
That's right. despite his half century in the wilderness, McCartney's 1961 Hofner bass guitar, which he purchased the year in Hamburg and used it on the Beatles' first two albums, including Love Me Do and She Loves You. Yeah.
I mean, that was the guitar he played on the Ed Sullivan Show. You know, I mean, that was his thing. It was looks like a violin, a big violin.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's a cool bass guitar.
It is.
It's real cool. This is a good one too, folks, so get ready. The famous composer Haydn,
yes,
18th century composer, mm-hmm. has two skulls in his tomb. The family of Haydn placed a holder skull in his tomb after tomb raiders stole his skull out of the sarcophagus that it was in.
Oh.
So the family said, well, we can't leave him there without a head. So they got a donor head and placed it in there. Now, that in itself is weird enough. But later, the head is recovered. The skull is recovered. The actual Haydn skull mm-hmm. is recovered. And they knew it because it said on the back, belongs to Haydn. Along with a pair of underwear that said Thursday and Friday.
And Friday, yes. Yeah, the washing machine wasn't invented yet.
So exactly.
Extend the wear. Yeah, okay.
So listen, so they find the actual skull later from the robber of the skull. Then they put that back in this tomb with the other head. So in Haydn's tomb, there are two skulls.
Well,
because two heads are better than one.
I was just going to say, two heads are better than one. Totally useless information with Nick and
When they found the guy who stole it, they said, what made you steal it? He said, well, I want to get a little head.
Right. That's right. He did. Wow. Now, I know you're a huge country fan. Have you heard of the hot country artist Jelly Roll?
I actually have, and he's a scary looking dude, I'll be honest.
Well, he got into some trouble because he was the CMA Award for New Artist of the Year. He was mm-hmm. nominated for two Grammy Awards. He has multiple number one singles off his debut country album. And it seems like these days everyone wants a piece of, well, Jelly Roll. Mm-hmm. Back in 2013, mm-hmm. apparently.
He's got a cousin, Jelly Donut.
That's right, that's his cousin. So back in 2013, the Waffle House didn't want anything to do with his music. In fact, they threatened to take him to court over it. Jelly Roll, by the way, his name is Jason DeFord, was an underground rapper and just dropped a mixtape called Whiskey, Weed, and Waffle House. Well, the problem was apparently he used their logo on the cover of the mixtape, which is a big no-no.
Ooh.
So there's copyright infringement here on top of the fact that he was kind of making fun of the Waffle House.
He's probably stoned when he did it. He didn't know.
He didn't know at all.
A good defense.
They sold for $10,000 after printing 10,000 of the mixtapes that he wanted to give out for free, but he settled for $10,000.
Wow. Listen, here's a really funny story. So we're traveling from New York to Florida
yeah.
to come here to live. And we're on the road. We get off an exit and there's a Waffle House. I said, let's just eat there. So my wife is very conscious of what she eats. So we get into the Waffle House. The woman says, what would you like? And I said, you know, do a couple eggs, some pancakes and toast and whatever. She's like, you want bacon and sausage and a half a cow? And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. So anyway, she gets to my wife and my wife says, do you make egg whites? And the woman goes, no, I'm sorry. I don't think we have those. Because who the hell down south asks for egg whites? Right. Nobody. It's a sacrilege.
But you said bring the whole cow. You're talking about bacon. Bacon doesn't come from cows.
No, it's steak and eggs.
Oh, steak and eggs. Gotcha. I'm sorry. I'm only used to Canadian.
Do you not know the order?
I'm only used to Canadian bacon.
Oh, there you go. I don't like Canadian bacon.
Well, you know...
it's ham. It's just ham.
Yeah, it is. It's cooked ham. So we used to go to a diner. So I'm gonna take you guys back to the audience. I'll take the audience back.
Oh, my God. The Red Derby.
The Red Derby Diner. And there was this waiter.
You folks know this story is true because we both know it.
That's right. And the waiter's name was George. And we say, George... Josh. Can you give us another Coke? Because, you know, this is before refills were in. You know, he's like, no charge. We were regulars. And
not
so
pickles, no charge.
I would always ask for, being the Canadian in the group, for Canadian bacon. He goes, no, don't have Canadian bacon. But every week we would go there, I'll always ask for Canadian bacon as if that week they would bring in Canadian bacon. No Canadian bacon.
No Canadian bacon. I give you a regular bacon.
No shush. Elvis Presley. Everyone knows Elvis Presley with his dark hair and dark sideburns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Elvis was a natural blonde.
No, they dyed his hair black.
He was a natural blonde until his late teens, and even after when his hair began to go darker, it wasn't naturally the shade we all know over the years. Mm. It was usually dyed with a shade of brown known as mink brown, but once the king himself tried to do it, he opted to use black shoe polish instead. So Elvis was a blonde.
Really? And at one time, Nick had hair. Yes. Lots of it, too. You looked like Art Garfunkel at one point.
That's right. I did. I did. I you know, I always joke. I say in high school I was voted most likely to recede, and I did.
Madonna, the queen of pop.
Yes.
That, have you seen a picture of her lately?
Yeah, pop goes the weasel.
Very scary. Yeah. Very, very scary.
Yeah.
Well, Madonna, the queen of pop. Her career actually did not start as a singer.
Oh.
No, she was in a group called The Breakfast Club.
Oh, okay.
And she was a drummer. She did not sing.
No.
Nope. Nope. It wasn't until they heard that she hadn't had sex and they said, you're like a virgin. No. No, but she actually left that band and went on to become a front person, a singer, and that's how it happened. But wow. She was a drummer in the band called The Breakfast Club.
That's amazing.
Okay. Yeah, cool. So now people, now you know all of this stuff. Plus, you know Dan Riskin's got ferrets and whatever in the colon. Whatever the hell else he finds in a colon.
Exactly. You're listening to Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy.
What's in the mailbag? What's in the mail?
Carl S.
Carl S.
From,
okay.
Yeah, from Milwaukee.
Oh.
That's the first one I've seen from Milwaukee, so cool.
Yeah, thank you.
He says, I don't believe that you guys are separated by thousands of miles. He says, mm-hmm. I don't believe it. I believe that you're doing the show in a studio. Hmm. And he said he also does not believe Nick when he says we use AI. Whatever. I don't know how the hell we would use AI anyway.
Like
but listen.
Okay,
Carl,
go ahead. Go on. Yeah,
Carl,
come on.
I am in sunny Florida right now.
Right.
It is, I think, 70 degrees as we speak. Right. Nick, you are where?
I'm in Toronto, Canada, and it's 70 degrees also in my oven.
Okay, Carl.
Yeah.
We are separated. There is a thing called Zoom, and we record our shows. We actually do see each other on the Zoom thing. We actually had a guest on. We saw him as well, which frightened me. But
just his face. Thankfully, just his face.
I wasn't talking about him, Nick.
Oh, okay.
Fine. No, but Carl, we are separated by, what is it, 1,800 miles?
1,500 last we checked.
1,500 miles.
Yeah.
Well, Nick is in Toronto, Canada. I am in Florida. Yes, we are.
By the way, it's coming up on the 5th anniversary of our show, and we have a special, something special coming your way in the fall as we celebrate 5 years of Totally Useless Information.
And Carl, that is true, too, as well.
Yeah. So, my mailbag comes from Suzanne from a fellow Canadian in Hamilton, Ontario, which is just west of Toronto. Dear Nick and Roy, we love listening to your show. We really enjoy you guys. It sounds like you're having a lot of fun. Yeah, well, whatever. Here's my
until
question.
Until the recording stops.
Here's my question. My daughter just got engaged.
Congrats.
Yeah. Her daughter got engaged, and her ring is absolutely beautiful. It is 2.5-carat diamond.
Hmm. I gave my wife a 3-celery diamond.
Well, what she wants to know is, why do they call it a carat?
Ooh.
So, Suzanne, thank you very much. Congratulations are in order for your daughter. And if you need MCs for your daughter, let us know. Go to nickandroy.com. Click on Contact Us. The name carat derives from medieval French, Italian, and from Arabic, jirat, meaning bean pod, which is itself from the Greek keration, referred to both the carob bean and a small weight. Early in the 20th century, the weight of the carat was set. So in the 20th century, the weight of the carat was set at 200 milligrams or 0.2 grams. Today on the show, we talked to Dan Riskin, our science guy. We talked about science.
We talked about music. We talked about Carl the Skeptic.
It's time for the news.
And now, from around the corner and around the world, this This is TUI News.
This news story kind of fits what we were talking about earlier. An investigation was underway after a man was captured on surveillance video placing antique items under his kilt.
I saw it.
Did you?
Did you see it?
Yes.
I did too. It was on the news and I saw it down. It wasn't in Florida. What's he walking around with a kilt? He was probably at the tow bar.
More like the tool bar.
No, so wait a second. So this man's walking around in a kilt.
Yes.
And in an antique store.
It was in Houston.
In Houston.
In Texas. Several cameras inside the antique dealer's booths captured the man placing an item under his kilt.
Where were these cameras that they captured them putting the item under his kilt? On the floor? Where were these cameras?
Well, wherever they were, they captured him not only placing an item under his kilt, they also captured him placing it back on the shelf.
No, wait a minute.
Uh-huh.
So did he place it in the front of the kilt or the back of the kilt?
We're not sure. According to one of the patrons...
Sounds to me like this is one for Dan Reskin.
So someone said that the antique dealers have access to the mall's Wi-Fi camera system, so they regularly watch to monitor their booths. They said, so one dealer spotted the man doing this. Now, they were looking for the guy, but guess what? They found him. And they arrested him. He's being held on only a $100 bond.
Well, of course. I mean, what do you do with a guy like this?
So, yeah, so he's under arrest. And
Did he have any items?
They removed because whatever. No, he didn't have any more up there. Whatever.
They had to do a cavity search, I would assume.
No, the dentist wasn't there. That's all the time we have on this episode of Totally Useless Information. We will scour the internet and other sources to find out more.
How did somebody steal one marble?
Useless information just for you.
5 years we've been doing this. We love doing it for you, and we love you for listening. Thank you so much.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Roy.
Thanks for listening.
Totally Useless Information with Nick and Roy was brought to you in part by Tom's Place for the finest in men's fashion. Tom's Place will suit you. Located in Toronto at 190 Baldwin Street in the heart of Kensington Market. Or visit toms-place.com.